This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business? You think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really gotta rap and be all that. But prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, for the past 30 years, the legendary Stan Winston has built some of the scariest and most memorable film effects by hand. But are digital effects rendering Winston's old-fashioned movie magic obsolete or indispensable? Hold my calls, please. It's The Business from NPR. Stan Winston moved to Hollywood in 1969 to become an actor, but a detour into the makeup department at Disney would be where he'd find his genius. Winston went on to win a handful of Emmys for his work in the 70s for makeup on epic TV shows like Roots and the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman. In 1984, his career took a turn for the terrifying when he created the makeup and effects for The Terminator, the film that would launch the careers of both director James Cameron and actor Arnold Schwarzenegger. The rest, as they say, is movie history. His studio did the makeup for Tim Burton's Edward Scissorhands, the terrifying Predator character, and the awe-inspiring dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. For practical, that is, non-digital, makeup and special effects, Winston is the go-to guy. So, we went to the Winston Workshop in the San Fernando Valley. The cavernous workshop of the Winston Studio is a hobbyist's dream. A doll's head the size of a Buick sits on top of a cabinet and seems to be overseeing a small army of young men carving wood and styrofoam, blowing the shavings off themselves with compressed air. Everywhere you look, there are parts from creatures you recognize, and many for movies coming soon to a theater near you. We even saw the amazing new suit of armor for the upcoming Iron Man, but it's so super secret, they erased our memories before we left the workshop. In one corner, there's a case filled with nothing but glass eyes for people, for dinosaurs, and for pigs. And there's even a pig that looks and feels extraordinarily real. It's Wilbur from the recently released Charlotte's Web.
And you can see here the various cables that move this pig around, rotate back, rotate forward, left ear, right ear, left eye, right eye, snout, Each cable runs into a servo, into this what looks like your average pig.
But as amazing as all of this is, you have to wonder whether these relatively old-fashioned film techniques can compete with the digital effects that are everywhere in movies and TV today. A few months after the release of the beautiful new book, The Winston Effect, The Art and History of Stan Winston Studio, we thought we'd talk with the man himself about special effects, storytelling, and the business. We sat down in the conference room of the Stan Winston Studio, which is filled with almost every one of the creatures that sprang from his imagination. They're ominously lifelike, and there's a sense that one false move, and they'd come to life to protect their genius creator. Stan Winston, welcome to The Business.
Very nice to be here.
How has your business, the Stan Winston Studios business, changed in the last 5 years because of digital CGI effects?
I don't believe that Stan Winston Studio has changed because of the introduction of CGI. Stan Winston Studio has been known to break ground and to innovate and do things in ways that people have not seen before. So under this roof is live action, animatronic effects, and digital effects. And we mix the medias. We do it in a way that I think is magic and use the tools in a way to shock you, have you see something you haven't seen before, and not know what technology is being used. And I think that's key to it all.
If the company hasn't changed that much, how have the movies changed?
I think there's a misconception about how much the movie business has changed, how much the world has changed. My philosophy is, and my view of the world and the film business is, everything has continued to grow in a very organic way. Nothing has changed dramatically. In King Kong, what could be done live was done live, but in King Kong in those days, the only thing that we were able to do live was a big hand that Fay Wray was in that moved in and out of the frame, and a large head of King Kong that was outside of a window. And the rest was done with stop-motion animation. Today's world, we can do that much more live. Our animatronics are far more advanced. We've used all the tools, as has the animator used all the tools. We also have digital animation, and that digital animation, like the animation you've seen in Jurassic Park, is organic and invisible because of the use of the computer, because of the finesse we can get out of the computer. Well, that parallels live action and animatronics, because the fact of the matter is the reason our animatronics are as organic as they are, the reason we were able to take a Tyrannosaurus Rex that weighed 18,000 pounds, 9 tons, and was able to act on command from Steven Spielberg and do it organically is we used a computer to design it, to help build it, to control it, to get the message from the puppeteers to the T-Rex.
Turn the light off. Turn the light off.
Turn the light off!
So, in fact, what we had was computer-generated animatronics. And it paralleled, at the same time, computer-generated animation. People just don't think like that. People say, well, now you can tell stories like they've never been told because there's nothing you can't do. Well, we were telling those stories a long time ago. We were telling those stories in the 1930s with King Kong. They just did it with a different technology, and that technology was accepted then because that's more than anybody had seen then. And it was like, whoa, I've never seen anything like this.
It sounds like from what you're saying that the question that I wanted to ask you, I can't, which is, you know, how is your work better than or worse than or totally different from digital CGI effects? But it sounds like what you're saying is they're already sort of working hand in glove.
Absolutely.
Together now anyway, and ever will it be so.
Exactly.
And
I'd be foolish not to use whatever technology is out there, whatever tool is there to help me create a character's performance, would be foolish not to use that.
But I've talked to directors who say that they are nostalgic for the time when practical effects were the preponderant means by which to tell that story. I was talking to Clive Barker recently, and he said, you know, the thing about CGI and green screen is that you don't get the visceral reaction from an actor that you get when they are right there. And we were talking about this before we came over here today, the scene in Aliens in which Sigourney Weaver is sort of recoiling in horror from the queen alien, and these slavering jaws have opened and dripping goo. It's such a powerful scene, and you have to imagine as the viewer that, you know, she probably – this creature is right on top of her. It's probably very hard for her to see a camera. It's very hard to get that kind of reaction when you put someone in front of a green screen and say, okay, now there's a scary monster right behind you.
Exactly.
You're not nostalgic for that?
Nostalgic for that. I believe in that. It's the way I make movies and will continue to make movies. being nostalgic about it means that it's yesterday's news.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe it's yesterday's news. I'll make movies today and tomorrow using live action as much as possible to give the actor those tools that they need to raise the bar of that performance. Any great actor will tell you that 50% of acting is reacting. The greatest actors will tell you that they'll give you their better performance when they have someone or something great to react to or with. And so, therefore, it is our job as filmmakers to, wherever possible, give the actor the tools that he needs to raise the bar of his performance, because that's what movies are. They're stories being told by wonderful characters, and those characters are usually played by actors, and you want those actors to give you the very best performance they possibly can.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. I'm talking to legendary special effects and creature maker Stan Winston. Earlier this year, Titan Books released a beautiful coffee table book celebrating his work called The Winston Effect, The Art and History of Stan Winston Studio.
Do you have to battle at all with studios, or do the filmmakers you partner with have to battle with the studios to make that case? I mean, it seems like the answer you hear a lot from the studios is, well, it's cheaper if we just do this CGI. CGI is supposed to be the great money saver. The irony is it seems like budgets have never been higher in history. We can get to that in a second. I'm just curious, to reinject this into a business context, how often do you or your storytellers have to fight to make that point?
I don't think fight is the word. I think sell is the word. Most of the time, if the filmmaker is not doing the selling as a Jon Favreau would sell his want as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, to use as much live action as possible and then augment with CGI, I will sell that as much as I possibly can to the filmmaker or to the studio who is making it. But there's only so much you can do. Like a Nemo or a Shrek or a Toy Story, which are films that I love. I love animated films, and perfectly comfortable. In fact, want to see that art form used completely in making that kind of movie, because it's an animated film. So it can be CG animation, it can be stop motion animation. It's a way a filmmaker makes a film. But once you are involved in making films with real people, I want things to be as organic as possible. And I know that the way to make them as organic as possible is to mix it up, is to not allow the film-going public to be aware of what they're watching. I believe that audiences will be ultimately bored by thinking that every time they go into a theater and they're going to see a fantastic character or creature, that it's not going to really be there, that it's going to be all animated. You don't want that. You want to see the real thing. You want to know that it's there. And the way to do that is to make it there, is to do as much live as possible. And it's the sale that I have to give to a studio, trying to get people to understand, no, you don't want to do it all digitally. You want to have live action there. You want to have something for an actor to react to. You want to have something on the set that is real, that even the digital artists have to raise the bar of the digital artistry to make sure that what they're doing looks like it would if it were real and on set. Even if what we're doing live is simply to give the digital artists information as to what the character looks like lit on the set with people there. We need to have that for the organic aspect of the film to work. Most filmmakers, and I don't mean directors, I mean studios, don't have a clue. There are movies out there that have failed because too much energy was given to the digital media. I can name a few. One was a script that I read that I loved and actually at one point wanted to direct. It was a movie called Dragonheart, and Dennis Quaid was in it. And there was this wonderful character, this dragon, who ended up having the voice of Sean Connery. And I wanted badly to be involved with that. And it was after we had done Jurassic Park. And I knew that the way to do it was to do it the way we did Jurassic Park. We'd build as much of this dragon full size to be there because it was an actor. It was a talking dragon. And then what we couldn't do, and there would be a lot of that, we would do with CG. In fact, when they made the movie, they opted to do the dragon completely CG. And I am a huge fan of Dennis Quaid as an actor. And I believe it was one of his flattest performances. And I believe I know why. Because the actor that he was acting against didn't exist. He was there talking to a dragon that wasn't there.
If I wanted my conscience pricked, I would have stayed with the priest. And what does a dragon know of the old code anyway?
His blade defends the helpless. His might upholds the weak. His word speaks only truth.
Shut up. I remember. That's all it is, a memory. Nothing can bring it back.
You sound like one who tried.
And failed. So I no longer try to change the world, Dragon. I just try to get by in it.
Yes, well, it's better than death, I suppose.
Oh, is it? I should think you'd welcome death. You know, the last of your kind, all your friends dead, hunted wherever you go.
I think we had the same kind of problem in Star Wars with Jar Jar Binks and Liam Neeson, who I think is a phenomenal actor, who, when he was in a scene with Jar Jar Binks, which was this digital character that was just jumping all over the place, completely insane, and Liam Neeson was just as flat as could be.
Oh, muy, muy, I love you.
You almost got us killed. Are you brainless?
I spec.
The ability to speak does not make you intelligent. Now get out of here.
No, no, Mr. Stay. Mr. called Jar Jar Binks. Mr. your humble servant.
That won't be necessary.
Oh, but it is. It is demanded by the gods, it is.
Because that performance that was there, that digital performance that was there at the end of the day, wasn't there when he was acting. And for me, it didn't work. I believe that Peter Jackson made the same mistake. And I'm a huge, huge fan of his. And I think some of the work that he did in the new King Kong and the face of King Kong was brilliant. And the expressions and the reality of the digital work in King Kong was absolutely brilliant. It was just wonderful. But I was out of the movie so many times because I was aware that everything that I was seeing was digital. It would have been so easy to build a full-size King Kong hand and arm where I actually felt her touching something real and allowed me to believe everything else. Now, if that movie was a completely digital movie and there were no live-action, live characters, I would probably I'd approach it in a different way and I'd look at it a different way. But it wasn't, and it required, I believe, the kind of magic that Peter put into Lord of the Rings, which was using it all, using all of the techniques, using all of the tools, and allowing us as an audience to enjoy it as a movie and enjoy the characters for what they were and not be aware of the fact that you're watching a digital fest.
We're talking to legendary special effects genius Stan Winston. His studio is responsible for some of the most iconic movie makeup, creatures, and effects in the past 30 years, from Terminator to Jurassic Park. Earlier this year, Titan Books released a coffee table book celebrating his work called The Stan Winston Effect, The Art and History of Stan Winston Studio. You're listening to The Business from NPR. This is The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. Stan Winston's studio is responsible for some of the most iconic movie makeup, creatures, and effects in the past 30 years, from Edward Scissorhands to The Terminator. But is the man responsible for making that T-Rex come to life in Jurassic Park in danger of becoming a dinosaur himself? Winston would argue just the opposite. We sat down with him in the conference room of the Winston studio, which is filled by almost every one of the creatures that sprang from his imagination.
I want to ask you about one of the most, I think, iconic scenes in a James Cameron movie. In Aliens, there's a scene where a gun is sort of mounted in a hallway, and there's this alien onslaught, and it seems as though millions and millions of these critters are just barreling down the hallway. And it's a scene that is, for me, as a kid, I can blame you. I can finally sort of point my finger at you and say, you ruined sixth grade for me.
I accept that.
I spent every night sort of, you know, with the light on and a flashlight near the bed. But there's this great tension because the camera cuts back and forth between these hordes of aliens and the number of bullets left in this gun. And it's always... Your breath is held as you want to see. Is there enough ammunition to repulse this wave? And the reveal, which I'll have you do now, is that what? How many aliens were actually made for that movie?
If I remember correctly, I believe we had 10 suits.
The fact that it appeared that there were hundreds, if not thousands.
It's the way it's shot. It's the way it's
when
cut.
There were only 10. That's what I want to ask you
that's
about.
That's filmmaking, though. That's editing.
Was that a function of the inability at that time to CGI your way out of that and that you made 10 and made it look like 100 or 1,000.
Absolutely. I think that's a very good point. The fact of the matter is if that had been done in today's world...
That's my question.
I don't believe that scene would have been as visceral as it was because you would have seen hundreds of aliens rather than felt hundreds of aliens not knowing where they're coming from, but every time you look, here come more. And the fact that you don't know where they're coming from and you don't know how many, but you feel the hordes of them is much more terrifying than seeing the hordes of them.
The follow-up to that is today, to get effects that would be less visceral and less compelling, would you have to spend more? That is, to animate 1,000 or 10,000 of these critters, what does that cost relative to building 10 suits for guys to jump around in? So does CGI ever become an expensive crutch?
Absolutely. I think more so than not. I think that unfortunately many filmmakers, would-be filmmakers, feel that because they don't understand what works and doesn't work, they don't know why it worked when it did work or why it didn't work when it didn't work. And that's most people, by the way. I feel that, you know, there are only a small percentage of directors that are really wonderful filmmakers, as there are a small percentage of artists who are really artists. That's across the board. That's everything in the world. That's every business. That's every everything. And the vast majority of people who pretend to be filmmakers know that they can get it all done with animation. They just don't know how that's really going to look or if it's really going to work or how it's going to really work. And I, being 60 years old and having the feeling that I have a real good idea of why things work, what works, what doesn't work, and I trust my instincts and I trust my taste and I basically do that because I look at the history of the work that's come out of this studio. I say that humbly because I didn't do it, but I was a part of the mix, and I've been able to go along with the artists that were doing the right thing and say, no to the ones that were doing the wrong thing and know the difference. Most filmmakers don't know the difference.
That's the reason, by the way, then, that we see movies' budgets balloon to $150 or $250 million, right? I mean, that because people don't know how it's going to look, when it does look like a big pile of poo, then they've spent $40 million on a particular chunk of the movie that no longer is compelling and cannot be released this way. And if you make a change to that, then you're looking at another $40 million.
Without knowing exactly the numbers we're talking about in any particular movie, absolutely. I mean, the biggest problem is not – let's put it this way. You can't point the finger at digital or technology or animatronics or makeup effects or animation as being the culprit with why films are costing too much money or not being made well and are failing.
This is a variant of the guns don't kill people argument, right?
Exactly. I believe that being an artist and being a filmmaker and is a responsibility. And it's a responsibility to the public, and it's a responsibility to the people who have the money, and I don't believe that most people understand it, take it and take it for granted, and they spend money and they throw it away, and it's because they shouldn't be making movies to start with.
And you will now name all of those directors.
I would never work again. I've been very fortunate, by the way. I mean, since you said that, there is a reason why Stan Winston Studio is as successful as it is. And it is because I've worked with the best directors. I truly have worked with the best directors in the world. And the best artists and technicians have worked under the roof of this building for many, many years. That's why I did the book. That's why the Winston Effect and Art and History of Stan Winston Studio is out now, and I'm proud of it, because it is easy for me to talk about it humbly, because I'm not talking about me, because it's not about what Stan Winston did. When you look around this room and you see all these characters, these are out of the minds of the most brilliant filmmakers in the world. These are characters that have come from the minds of people like Steven Spielberg and Jim Cameron and Tim Burton. And those visions have been helped to get on screen by the brilliant artists that are under this roof, who are the Renaissance artists of the 20th and 21st century. Days of Michelangelo, they work for the churches. Today, we work in the motion picture industry.
The great Stan Winston, creator of the Stan Winston Studio and the subject of a new book, The Winston Effect. Stan, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts covering politics, news, music, arts, and culture. For more details, visit kcrw.com.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with super handling all-wheel drive. More at acura.com/RDX.